Welcome, everybody. We are on week five of this session in which we are working our way through the section on time from knowledge of time and space. And we're going to continue with that in the next session, which is session eight. There'll be a break in between, but then we'll just continue working our way through. So I may have said this before, but you know, there's so much material in the TSK books, I certainly don't feel that I can stay on top of it all the time. In other words, it's not all fresh in my mind. And so coming back to knowledge of time and space after not having looked at it for a while and reading this time section, it's just, you know, remarkable to me how many wonderful insights and approaches there are. And I hope that's coming clear. It's certainly becoming more and more clear for me. So we're going to continue talking about that, and that was just a little encouragement to stay with the material here. And when you find things that seem difficult, well, that's part of the reason we have these phone calls. But also, it's not essential that you understand everything. Not essential. Just let it kind of wash over you. And return to it. Go back to it repeatedly. Okay, so we will follow the same pattern we've been following for a few weeks. I'm going to say a few things to orient us, and then we'll do a practice and work with that and get feedback from that. And then go on to the rest of the material that was the assigned reading. So, okay, somebody has a little bit of an echo. Let me see if I can figure out who that is. Not right now. Okay.
Probably Joanna.
Yeah.
Looks like Joanna. Okay, Joanna just muted herself. Okay, we're fine. Thanks, Joanna. The start of this material, so we're in this section called Measuring Out. Maybe I should say something again about the term Measuring Out that we've discussed in over the past several sessions, really. The idea is that time measures out. It's not the only thing time can do. But in our ordinary understanding, time measures out, and the obvious way that it measures out is in terms of measuring out days and weeks and seasons and hours and so on, and that's what's discussed, I believe, somewhere in this reading. I actually don't see it right at the moment, but that's how time measures out. But what we've also been looking at is that time really measures out, specifies the whole order that we find ourselves inhabiting, the temporal order. Which I'm using pretty much as synonymous with the logos. I think that's legitimate. So we've been looking at the specification of the logos, of the temporal order, as a way of connecting with the dynamic of time. There's a place later in this chapter, and maybe we'll talk about it a little more later if we have time, a place later in the chapter where Rinpoche says, we're so intent on assigning everything its position that we ignore, you could say, the temporal velocity. And he uses the word velocity, but what he's talking about here is the kind of dynamic through which something presents itself. You know, everything is a presentation. When we say that something exists, we're talking about a verb. We're talking about, you know, this desk that I'm sitting at exhibits itself, presents itself, makes itself available. And in doing that, it gets measured out by the temporal order. It gets assigned its place. But the place we know how to look at, the dynamic of its presentation, we don't. One way to think about that is in terms of atomic theory, you know, where we say everything is this swirl of atoms that's alive and active all the time. That's a good analogy. I don't think it's the same thing, but it at least helps convince us maybe that our sense that everything is just static is misguided, or at least is only one possible interpretation. Here I think we're talking about a different kind of dynamic, but still we're talking about a kind of momentum. And as it says in the beginning of the reading for this week, the Logos has its own momentum at the very bottom of page 62. Right? It says there's a momentum inherent in the Logos. Everything is manifesting. And for that to happen, there has to be a certain momentum. Now, in the orientation, I said that last week we made this strong distinction. We talked about the dynamic of time and the momentum of linear time, and we said, oh, momentum, that shows us that we're in the wrong domain. The moment we start talking about momentum, we're talking about linear time. But I should have anticipated that in the reading for this week, the word momentum is used a little differently, in as much as there's this lower level momentum, that's the momentum of linear time. But then in these readings, the word momentum is used to talk about the dynamic of second-level time. So there's a second-level momentum. And that's a little different from what we talked about last week, so I apologize if there was any confusion. But I think as it's presented here, it's quite clear. There's a second-level momentum. And that momentum there's an echo from somewhere. That would be from the call-in, I think. That's probably Klaus. I don't know. Anyway, that momentum gives us the temporal order of first-level linear time. So that's this rather complicated image. It's a very fine image, but it's complex, about the fabric and the pattern that's imprinted on the fabric. What we would like to be able to do, what's being suggested here, is that if we tune in to the momentum of second-level time, and we've talked about various ways of doing that, and we'll look at some more, or we'll look at that again today, if we tune into the momentum of second-level time, then that momentum becomes inseparable from what it presents. So in this image of the robe or the fabric on the top of page 63, says if we can take into account the momentum inherent in the Logos, then a new kind of knowledge opens up to us. We can know with the knowing of the Logos, and at that point, he says, the design that's found on the fabric that's woven, right, is inseparable from the pattern that determines the cut of the robe and the fold of the robe, the pattern, the design, the fabric. They're all, they conform precisely to one another, as though the fabric had been woven to accept this very pattern. And that really, we can put it even more strongly than that. It's the temporal order, the world we live in, is exactly the expression of the dynamic of time, the second-level dynamic of time. And so we are exploring the possibility that we could engage this second-level momentum or this temporal dynamic, and we're asking, how could we activate the knowledge that would let us do that? Right? How could we arrive at the point that the design, again, I'm quoting here from page 63, the design woven into the fabric is inseparable from the fabric itself. So, ordinarily, time is, we've talked about this, is mysterious. It's something that we don't have access to. We just have access to what time measures out, and to the measures themselves. We don't really have access to the dynamic of time. But if we can know with the knowing of the Logos, the presentation that is being presented, then that dynamic is available as the presentation. You know, the design gives us the fabric in the same way that the fabric gives us the design, you could say. So it's not that we have to come to know something differently. It sounds that way. I think everything I've said that until now probably sounds that way. But that's a little misleading, because the very notion that there's someone at the center, there's a self at the center, and I need to know, this I that's at the center, needs to know time differently, that's a contradiction. That's you know, now we're trying to talk out of both sides of our mouth, as we say in English. The reason that would be problematic is that the notion that there's a self at the center who knows is a part of the pattern that the second level momentum gives. So the knowing is not going to belong to the self, and that's a really fundamental point throughout TSK. I've quoted before a very simple statement that I think gets to a very central point in TSK, and that is that knowledge is not what the knower knows. So the knowledge that we're activating here, that we're looking for ways to activate, is not my knowledge. The temporal order that we inhabit is already a temporal order in which there is a self that knows. So the knowing, the ordinary lower level knowing, is a part of the presentation. So if we could put time at the center, something we've talked about many times, instead of putting the self at the center, then that knowing would become just a part of the presentation. And a deeper knowing would be activated. So it's a different, it's a very nice way of thinking about the relationship, actually, between time and knowledge. Just as there's a relationship between space and knowledge, when we can activate a different time and open to a different space, then in that very action, in that transition, we are also activating a different knowledge. So, in this first chapter in the reading, part of what we discover we discover several things. There's some discussion of this on page 64 of this very short chapter. In the first full paragraph on 64, Rinpoche talks about the temporal order presenting patterns of repetition and duplication. There's a sameness to it. And this is part of what is inherently frustrating about lower level time. It's very difficult to move away from that sameness. That's part of the temporal order. Another part of the temporal order is exactly what we've just been talking about, that let me read from that first sentence in the first paragraph on 64. If time presents the temporal order of repetition and duplication, knowledge arises as the knowing of a self, that is, a knowing that belongs to a self, that accepts those patterns as ultimate truth. So here I am, I look around, I see that things duplicate themselves, they repeat themselves. I think I also see certain kinds of a kind of static quality. Things are what they are, and I'm not really aware of the dynamic of their presentation, which we talked about earlier. And that exactly is the knowing that is available to a self. That's what a self can know. And if that's what we discover, then we also have to presuppose a self that is doing that knowing. It's all part of the same package. You know, it's like you go to a travel agent and you buy a package tour. and you go to a particular location, and once you're in that location, which it happens to be our world in this case, then you're also the self that is in the center of all that, knowing all this, and there isn't any way out of it. Which, you know, when from that point of view, when Descartes says, well, there has to be a self because here I am asking the question about whether there's a self, that move is the only move you can make. If you're, that is the move that says there has to be a self, once the whole structure of knowing and the whole structure of time and the whole structure of space is in place, it all goes together. So what's the alternative to that? Well, we see that in the last paragraph on page 64, and this leads us, is going to lead us to where we do some practice. He says, it doesn't have to be that way, right? So actually, if we go up to the end of the previous paragraph, he says, once we're in this temporal order of repetition and duplication, then knowing is the knowing that belongs to a self, right? But if knowledge authorizes the intimacy of knowingness, so knowingness here is a word, it's used a lot in the TSK books, and I think we can see here what it's pointing to is a knowingness that's kind of inherent in the situation as opposed to a knowingness that belongs to a self that knows. Right? So if knowledge authorizes the intimacy of knowingness, the dynamic of time wells forth without restriction. Wells forth is a nice phrase that's not used very often in English. I'm saying this for non-native English speakers, but you know, English speakers don't think about this either. So, and I haven't thought about it a lot, but welling forth has this sense of a kind of spontaneous arising without any effort. So that's the welling forth. So knowledge unfolding through time. So this is not the, well, I won't say any more about that. Points equally toward energy and awareness, embodiment and openness. And that gives access, he says, to a motionless quality within motion. So there is this suggestion here that what's fundamental in time isn't really movement. There's a dynamic. But that dynamic doesn't have to express itself as movement. The fact that we link those two has a lot to do with our ordinary understanding of linear time. So the momentum of time shows up in a linear way, which means there has to be movement from past to present to future. But that's a kind of a secondary quality that is related to this particular temporal order. Right? And he goes on, he makes that point just so strongly you can't possibly mistake it. He says, when communication between time's dynamic and the awareness within knowledge, so let's look at that again. When communication between time's dynamic and the awareness within knowledge, so inherent in knowledge, there's this more fundamental awareness. Inherent in time, there's this dynamic. And when those two attain true intimacy, right, I make a lot of gestures when I'm teaching, but you don't usually see them because it's just a head shot here. But I'm sort of spinning my fingers around here. I don't know if you can, there you go. Like that, right? Time and knowledge, true intimacy. That's actually not a very good picture of true intimacy, but it'll have to do for now. When we arrive at that true intimacy, the outcome is time is invariable. Doesn't mean that it's somehow frozen. It means that it's always available in this way that is invariable. And knowledge is fully lucent, which is a lovely notion that we'll just pass over for now. Mind and matter come together in a dynamic, pointless, motionless aliveness. So that's a reflection. That's not exactly the walkabout practice, but to reflect on what is actually being suggested with those words, dynamic, pointless, motionless aliveness. The heart of great time or the body of knowledge. So that's a very kind of inspiring notion. Sudhi writes, that reminds me of the stillness and the movement in meditation and the two being simultaneously present. So, yeah, if you do a meditation, I don't know exactly what kind of meditation you're referring to here, but if you do a meditation in which stillness and movement are simultaneously present, then that is very closely related. It seems to be a way of describing what is being pointed at here. Stillness in movement, mind in matter, time in knowledge, all of that embodied and lucent together. So, you know, it's tempting to try to find other words, but there's a kind of a poetry to this that I don't want to, you know, can't pretend to really be able to just spout. Sudhi clarifies that she's talking about mindfulness meditation as described by Duchen Lingpa in Adra Essence. Okay, I'm not familiar with that. Okay, let's look a little bit. So we want to look at this idea of intimacy. And we're going to do the practice that was assigned for this week, exercise 25 in the DSK book, which is called intimacy. But I want to point to some ways to investigate that, and it's related to some factors that I mentioned in the orientation for this week. And they were factors that I pulled out of the reading for the previous week. The factors of intention and appreciation and inquiry. So I want to just specify those a little bit as a way perhaps of then being able to explore intimacy. So the intention with which we engage experience, given what we've been saying, we'd have to say it's not the intention of the self, right? It's not what I want or intend to do, but there is a kind of an intentionality within appearance that arises in accord with a kind of underlying imperative, I want to say, but that's just adding another I word to intention. It's the intention, right? So that becomes more clear, perhaps, if we think about the word appreciation. Appreciation has to do with a kind of total acceptance, another A word. Actually, very interesting how all these words are vowel words in English. Intention and appreciation and intimacy and aliveness. And somehow, vowels are open. You know? But of course, that's just in English. But it can still be a kind of interesting pointer. Okay, so appreciation is a kind of acceptance of whatever comes up, and that means going along with the inherent intentionality of the situation, not trying to impose your own intentionality on it. Or that's a way of thinking about it. And then the third factor is inquiry. So intention, appreciation, and inquiry. That's what I talked about in the orientation, and those are terms that come from the previous week's reading. And I believe Rinpoche actually says that appreciation, there's a natural inquiry. The inquiry that's being talked about here, I think, this is something one could spend a long time exploring, all of these things are, but it's not necessarily the kind of inquiry in which you ask critical questions. You know, something comes up and you say, well, is that really what's going on? You know, that kind of challenging questioning. That can be very useful, and that may be a way in. But I think here the inquiry is more just this complete openness, kind of like a child's inquiry. It's like, well, what's going on? You know? When you see little babies, they're just open to everything. They just want to know. And I think it's, you know, that kind of open inquiry. So intention, appreciation, and inquiry. So with those factors in mind, maybe we can think about how that actually relates to the practice, which we're going to do now for a few minutes, of intimacy, exercise 25. So here's what the paragraph that gives the heart of that exercise says. Try to notice in all your thoughts, sensations, and direct encounters, the objects and outside standards that make appearance meaningful. So the word that's used in KTS, in Knowledge of Time and Space, is not outside standard, but outsider. But it's the same thing. So try to notice the objects and outsiders that make appearance meaningful. In other words, if nothing was going on, if nothing showed up, nothing would be meaningful. You might argue that at a certain level, but fundamentally in our ordinary experience. But things do show up, and so then experience becomes meaningful because what shows up stands in relation to other things that show up and stands in relation to the one to whom they show up. And that pattern of a knower knowing is a meaningful pattern. It may be a limiting pattern, but it's meaningful. Okay. So try to notice the objects and outsiders that make appearance meaningful. For each object encountered or referred to, and this includes objects like thoughts and emotions, whatever you notice, whatever comes to mind, you could say, whatever you notice, for each object encountered or referred to, note it and embrace it in its immediate givenness as being part of you. You can do this by saying, that too is I, and by extending your sense of located awareness to embrace the apparently separate and distant object. So those two alternatives that are presented are ways for the self to get into this practice, because we're saying there's a knowing that doesn't belong to the self, and it has to do with intimacy. And the question is, well, so how does the self engage that? Well, here are two possibilities. By essentially expanding the sense of self, either through saying, that too, what I've encountered, is I, or by extending your sense of located awareness, here I am aware of this, to embrace the apparently separate and distant object. Those are both transitional moves. They're not the truth of the matter, you could say, but they're a way of cultivating this sense of intimacy. So you've worked with this practice during the week, so I'm not going to say any more about it. Let's take a few minutes to practice it and see how people respond, what kind of experience people have and want to share. Okay. Okay. So let's come back together. And I invite you to share your experience. And we've got a couple of comments already. So great, we'll start with that. So Hayward says, it seems that I as subject and that as object share the intimacy of the moment which presents us together. Yeah, that's, I think, a very nice way of putting it. Rinpoche says at least a couple of times in the TSK books, he says, you know, it's valuable to reflect on how remarkable it is that the only guarantee of reality, the way we say, well, this is what's real, that it comes from the fact that we are in this moment. You know, if we weren't in this moment, if we say 100 years ago, you say, well, that used to be real, but now it's the past. It's not real in the same sense. So what is it about our presence that is somehow a guarantor of reality? And what you're suggesting is a nice complement to that observation, because there's an intimacy with everything that exists in this present moment. And the specific relationship between the object that we encounter and the sense of the self that encounters it, maybe that's exactly the best place to experience it. But that's what we want to be able to explore. Okay, so Caroline says, intimacy seems to be almost a method to facilitate access to and movement between levels of time, space, and knowledge, akin to Robert Heinlein's grokking. Yeah, I don't know about grokking. I mean, I did reread that book about 10 years ago. This is a book called Stranger in a Strange Land. And some of you may know it. It was a very popular book. I imagine it's available in other languages also. There's that sense, yeah, of a kind of a heartfelt engagement. So I think that's right. I think intimacy is kind of a method to facilitate access. But it's also true that intimacy is a marker for engagement with the dynamic or momentum of time. When we are in contact with intimacy, that depends on and manifests the engagement of time. So let's go back to that sentence at the end of page 64. When communication between time's dynamic and the awareness within knowledge attains true intimacy, then the outcome is time is invariable and knowledge as fully loosened. So intimacy is one of the words we have available to us, just like the word lucency, you could say. That it's just a word, but it's pointing towards something that shows us a transition. And in moments of intimacy, there is a transition. And one of the reasons the word works, you know, words take on power because they point us towards something true. And we've all had experiences of intimacy. And you could say that in those experiences, the dynamic of time is more readily available. Okay, Klaus says, I'm afraid of doing this practice because it seems to point into a psychopathic direction, like the person who thinks to be Jesus and is diagnosed with being psychotic. Ah, that's interesting. There is a discussion in the commentary in Exercise 25. Rinpoche says, this may sound like, I don't think he uses the word psychotic or psychosis, but
megalomaniac
or monomaniacal selfishness. That's how he describes it. It helps to counter. Okay, it might at first seem to set up a monomaniacal selfishness, but actually, if practiced carefully, it will undermine the idea of a solid and continuous self. So I'm reading from the commentary to Exercise 25. So, you know, I think you need to honor what you're feeling. if it seems as though there is something here that is potentially, you know, could throw off your whole understanding of reality in a direction that made the self into everything, then, you know, approach it with caution. Approach it lightly, very lightly. But the point that's being made here is that I think when you discover that intimacy, then that very naturally means that the self at the center loses its central place. It's kind of playing a trick on the self. I'm not sure this is the best way to say it, but it's like, you know, first you say, "Oh boy, self, have I got something for you? You get to be everything," you know, and so the self starts off to do that. But as you know, if you are allowing, if you do it, and that's one reason why I think it's important to look at these three factors of intention and acceptance, or rather appreciation and inquiry. If you do it in a way that's open to all the possibilities that come out of this experience, then the claims of the self get undermined in the course of doing the exercise. So as Rinpoche says, it may sound like it's monomaniacal, but it actually undermines the claims of the self. Well, let's go ahead and look at some more comments. Eliana says, open to the senses without judgment can bring a connection and depth lost when the self and the mental chatter predominate. Yes. Yes, so opening here that quality of appreciation as a very important way into intimacy, and opening especially to what the senses present, that's when you discover intimacy, and aspects of intimacy are connection and depth, which is exactly what you pointed out. I think that there's a way of opening to experience that in the same way that you do it with the senses. The senses are very natural because the senses just naturally are a kind of channel to something that can't really fit within the self's ownership claim so tightly. But it's also possible to open even to your own thoughts, even to the mental chatter. You know? So it's true that mental chatter goes along with the self because mental chatter is mostly about what the self is worried about or concerned about or wants or fears. That's what it's all about. But if you can, maybe here the quality of inquiry becomes most important, because if you can just say, well, what's going on with all this mental chatter? And then underneath the activity, you discover perhaps the emotionality, and then underneath the emotionality, you discover something like the you know, the fundamental claims of the self. Now you're getting into a kind of appreciation for what's showing up, and that appreciation quite naturally undermines those negative dimensions. But that's a different level of practice. I think it's a level that's more difficult to access than simply, as you say, Eliana, opening to the senses without judgments. So Karin says it can be a joyful practice. Good. So that's the balance between, you know, from what we've been saying so far, which makes it sound like, oh, we have to deal with in some way these monomaniacal claims and the mental chatter and all of that. No, it can be a joyful practice. Staying playful with everything that arises. Like noticing wonders, that too is I. So I think you're saying, like, what a wonder, what a remarkable thing, that too is I. And certainly, there's a certain level, this may sound just like words, but there's a certain level in which you say, well, of course, whatever appears appears to me. You know, I have a stake, I have an engagement with everything. And that quality of intimacy, if we don't immediately turn it toward ownership, That kind of intimacy can turn us toward the dynamic, the momentum of time. And let's see, Caroline goes back to the kind of negative aspect. Is it the edge of fear which heralds the approach of an unknown revelation? And I think sometimes that is right. Fear can... I'm not sure what else to say. Certainly, it may be that we can use fear if we open to that with inquiry. You know, we say, well, what's going on in this fear? It's not that we have to answer that question kind of in a psychological way, but if we're just open to it and appreciate the manifestation, then that could lead into the unknown, and fear could come up as a response to the unknown. It's different for different people, but that does happen. I think the answer is yes. Michael says, and this is the last comment we have, and we're pretty much at the end of our time, so we'll end with this. That too is I extends my participation into other minds and perspectives. I can inhabit the perspective of my dog barking in the backyard while remaining inside the house. I can see a reflection of the tree out back in the mirror. Exporting the sense of I to other points helps to weave a wider realm of sensitivity. So that, again, is nicely put. I like this description of exporting the sense of I to other points. I like it in part because it shows the limitations of that approach. You know, that is what the exercise invites us to do, and we start there. But as we do that, we loosen our commitment to the self. You know, we develop a greater inquiry. I mean, the dog barking in the backyard, we have less immediate connection to that than we do to my hearing the dog. But that just is almost an accident of where we happen to be situated. So I mentioned that line before that Rinpoche uses later in these chapters for today when he says, we're intent on determining the position of everything, but as a result, we lose the velocity, we lose the dynamic, we lose the aliveness of what it is that we're experiencing. And that's what this focus on time is encouraging us to do. Okay, we'll stop there. There are many interesting points that come up in the reading and that we didn't get a chance to talk about, and I'll say a little bit about those in the transition and orientation for next week. Okay, thank you, everybody.